This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We'd like to begin the program today by talking about young people and housing. Buying a home used to be a major rite of passage of adulthood, but now more young people are not only putting it off, they're also moving back home with parents. According to U.S. Census data, the rate of home ownership for young adults has declined in the past decade from 43.6% to just over 36% today, and that could have serious implications for the wider economy. We wanted to talk more about this, so we've called NPR Senior Business Editor Marilyn Giwex. Once again, welcome back, Marilyn. Thanks for joining us again.
Hi, Michelle. Great to be here.
And for additional perspective, we've also called Lisa Sturdivant. She is the Vice President for Research at the National Housing Conference. Lisa, thank you for joining us as well here in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
So, Marilyn, let me start with you. By the numbers, it seems that the housing market is strengthening. You reported on this. But you were talking with realtors who came to Washington last week for a conference. There's an underlying concern underneath that.
Yes, I spent a lot of time last week with thousands of realtors who were in town, and I listened to their economists. And here's the big picture. It was a very tough winter, a lot of snow. People didn't want to go out to an open house when there's 3 feet of snow in the driveway, so that was a bad period. But now that it's warmed up and the snow is melting, things really have turned up, and it's looking like a pretty good year for housing. Prices are up, sales are looking reasonably strong. Housing starts surged a lot in April, so it feels pretty good. But then, if you dig into the numbers and separate it a little bit, what you really see happening is it's the higher end of the market that's doing well. Vacation home sales are good, and the typical new home price is now about $290,000, which is
the highest. The average new home price.
The median price is up to $290,000, and that is the highest ever recorded. So in other words, what's happening is the home builders are aiming for that. The first home being a pretty expensive home. You know, this new home is for people who have really high incomes, and that's a tough problem if you're a younger person. The statistics on that were much more dismal. They're finding that they're about, they call them the missing young people. They're missing because they're not in apartments. They're not buying homes. There are about 3 million missing young people. And where they seem to be is in mom and dad's basement. They're just staying at home with their parents.
So Lisa, pick up the thread here, if you would. Is the issue here that young people are not making enough money to get into the market? Is it that that people with more money are bidding up the cost of the homes? What's going on
here?
Yeah,
no, I think you're exactly right. I think, you know, there's problems on the demand side for young people, as we can talk more about. They're entering into the labor market in one of the worst economies that we've had in decades. And so, and not only that, as we've come out of the economic recession, the number of jobs that are being added and the types of jobs are frankly different than what we lost. The jobs that we're adding are lower wage jobs. They tend to be in sectors that pay a little bit less. And so they're faced with lower job prospects, and they're also saddled with higher debt in the form of student debt. And then add on top of that the demographic factors in that they're delaying getting married. And so when you have only one income in a household instead of two, all of those things make it more difficult to buy a home.
But, you know, but we actually reached out on Facebook because we wanted to hear what other people's experiences were. And let me tell you, a lot of people would like to talk about this. We got hundreds of responses on this question on Facebook. Mm. And I just want to read one of them from somebody who doesn't have any of those things that you talked about and still feels that he's priced out of the market. We heard here's Mark Hasselberg. He's 30 years old. He lives near the San Francisco Bay Area. He is married. He and his wife both have steady jobs. Together, they made almost about $95,000 last year, but they found they can't afford to buy a home anywhere near where they work. Here's what he had to say.
Owning your own home is definitely at the top of our list of priorities, so to speak, or at least so we thought until we started looking into it more, especially in the town and area we live now, which we love. It's a great neighborhood. We got friends and family close by. But to find something that we could actually afford, we'd have to move about 4 hours away.
So I think people will hear that and they'll think, is this lifestyle, that young people aren't willing to make lifestyle compromises, or is it something else?
No, I'm so glad that you raised this point. I'm so glad to hear that comment, because in the places where jobs are the best, in places like San Francisco and Washington, D.C., what we're facing is a supply problem. And so when you're faced with a place that constrains supply through zoning, through land use plans, reducing the amount of housing that comes onto the market, that also has this impact of keeping prices high.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about why so many young adults are staying out of the home buying market. Our guests are Lisa Sturdivant of the National Housing Conference. That's who is speaking just now. Also with us, NPR business editor Marilyn Geewax. Let me play, Marilyn, for you a clip from Jessie Hunter. She's 26 years old. She lives and works in Austin, Texas. She has stable work in the healthcare industry. She says she can get the money together to buy a house. Here's part of what she told us.
I have enormous student loans that essentially comprise a month's rent every month, and it eats up all of my disposable income. I'm not really able to save any money, even though I've got a fantastic job.
So, Marilyn, what about that?
That's exactly what the economists are telling the realtors, that this student debt problem is just a tremendous overhang on the market. This year in the class of 2014, congratulations, kids, you're the most indebted in history. 70%, 7 out of 10 kids coming out of college have debt. And right now that's running at about $33,000 per person. So that's, if even after you adjust for inflation, that's twice what it was 20 years ago. So people who were graduating in the 90s, they could pay off that debt in a few years, maybe 5 years, and then you could start to move on to buying a home. But now, you know, really young people are looking at debt overhang of, you know, they're well into their 30s before they can even start to feel their way out of that pile of debt. And then you've got to start to save for that first home. So it delays the whole process. And it makes people reluctant to get married. Who wants to marry into somebody else's debt? Now you got twice as much debt. It's really delaying the whole process that leads to adulthood.
I want to ask each of you whether this is a policy issue, or is this something that the country needs to worry about as a policy issue, or is it in fact a matter of people making different choices given the circumstances that they are presented with? And I just want to read this from Christian Moore, who says he's 27 years old. He says, I gross well over the median American, but I'm not even close to home ownership because he graduated. He had student loan debt, about $25,000. He says he's paid a lot of it down, but he's making payments on a modest car. He says, but look, I take vacations. I see concerts. I budget. So he's not whining. I'm not whining, but look, real estate prices where he lives are high. The median home price for a two-bedroom home is $257,000, according to Zillow. So he says, look, if I save 20% of my net income, I could afford a 20% down payment and have little or no nest egg in case of an emergency. And he says, look, to sum it up, I think me and a lot of my peers would rather have a meaningful life experiences than save up to buy a home. So how do you hear that? I mean, well, I think some people will think he's whining. I don't think he's whining.
I talked to some of the realtors about that and said, you know, what about when you talk to young people, what are they telling you? And they said, you know, one of the things they want to do is to be to enjoy their lives a little bit, to not just constantly feel this sense of debt burden, where if you have a student debt and you have a car loan and then you're going to take on a mortgage, a lot of them are like, hey, you know, this is all I care to really deal with. I want to still have some life. And the other thing is they want to be able to chase a better job. So they don't want to have that sense of roots, because what if something better opens up in another city? They want to be able to chase a better paycheck. So this one realtor I was speaking with from the state of Washington said it's really tough to get younger adults to commit to owning a home because they can't take the psychological burden of more debt, and they want to be free enough to move on to greener pastures.
Well, so one can understand why realtors would be very interested in having people, you know, the market continuing to turn over, because that's how they make their money. They make money off the transactions. But should the rest of the country care about this? I mean, is this a problem to be solved, or just a circumstance that's interesting?
No, I think that's a great question. And I think I'm glad that we're talking about the fact that this is a preference among a lot of folks in this generation. I think there's one thing to consider is that homeownership in America is the way that wealth gets accumulated. It's the primary means by which we accumulate wealth. So if that mechanism for this generation to accumulate wealth isn't working the way it has in the past, I think it opens questions about how we treat renters and their prospects for accumulating wealth over the long term, so that we don't increase this divide between wealth accumulation, not only by income group up now, but by generation.
Did Marilyn, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to say on this issue, speaking for us baby boomers, there are a lot of people who think, hey, I got mine, I'm cool. I bought a house young and I've, you know, been paying on it, so everything's set. But to sell my house, someday I will want to retire eventually, and I will probably want to downsize my house. who's going to buy it? So if you baby boomers are thinking, hey, we're cool, you're kind of not, because you need to have that chain moving along, the kind of the conveyor belt where somebody who's 29 buys a small home and then they move to the nicer one, and eventually they can buy my house and I can retire and have some savings from that sale. If you break down this chain, it can affect every generation. We all have a stake in how younger people are doing.
Is there the economists that you spoke with at the Realtors Conference last week have a perspective on how this issue should be addressed? Because on the one hand, when young people aren't willing to move for opportunities, people are critical of them. It seems like the young people are being criticized no matter what they do. I mean, so do they have a sense from a policy standpoint if there's something that they think should be different? And we also haven't had time to mention or dig into the whole question of underwriting standards, because a lot of people are saying that the underwriting standards have gotten very difficult for new buyers to overcome. We don't have time to really dig into whether that's true or not. But what's your take on it,
Marilyn? Keep in mind, these realtors were here in Washington, not a coincidence. They were here to go to the Hill. They were talking with their elected officials. And really, where they're looking for some kind of relief is some of the lending standards they feel are just really too high, that there's been a reaction to what happened when things were too loose. But now it's really tough on, especially minorities, a lot of Latino and African-American families who had a rough time. This was a really bad recession. So maybe your credit score got beat up pretty good in 2008 and 2009 when you had to live on credit cards to get by. Maybe now you're working again. Actually, you're a good risk and you have a family, you want a home, but that credit score that's still dragging over from a couple of years ago is still haunting you. So they want help with that.
Marilyn G. Wex is Senior Business Editor at NPR. Lisa Sturdivant is the Vice President for Research at the National Housing Conference. They were both kind enough to join us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Ladies, thank you both so much.
Well, good to be with you.
Welcome.
Just ahead, people who want a free and open internet are worried that the World Wide Web is becoming anything but free and open. The government has opened up the internet rule book and will consider if some providers like Netflix and Google should be able to pay more for better service for their customers. We'll take a look at this and other net news that's just ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Louis C.K.'s comedy about divorce, parenting, work, and sex often takes his audiences to uncomfortable places.
You feel a little sweat on the back of your neck when you get there, but if you stay there for a second, you can find something joyful and funny in it.
Louis C.K. talks about the new season of his FX series, Louis, on the next Fresh Air. Join us.
Weekdays at 11 a.m. and 7 p.m. on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Global Commodity Analytics, Lafayette; Taylor Higgins Agency, Rankin; Ray's Heating and Air Conditioning, Urbana. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
This is Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin. We're going to spend a good chunk of the rest of the day's program talking about issues in the media that all happen to bubble up at the same time. Later, we'll talk about why the new fall season just got more colorful. We'll hear about one show that puts an Asian American family front and center in a network sitcom for the first time in 20 years. But first, we're going to talk about a story involving one of the giants in the news business, the New York Times. It has become a front page issue itself. On Wednesday, Jill Abramson, the first woman to serve as executive editor of the New York Times, was dismissed after just 2.5 years on the job. That set off a firestorm of counter-narratives, as we like to say in the media. One narrative was that Abramson was abrasive and difficult to work with and had lost the confidence of her newsroom. The other was that Times management was critical of her for behavior that is not only tolerated but even expected of male leaders. And oh, by the way, was paying her significantly less than the man who held the job before her. The Times denies this strongly. Somewhere buried in the back of this story is also the fact that Dean Baquet, who succeeds Abramson as executive editor, is the first African-American in that job, making history of his own. So we wanted to talk about all of this and what it means. So we've got two people with a very good vantage point on this. Veteran journalist Susan Glasser is the editor of Politico magazine, and she wrote about this in the article Editing While Female. Susan, welcome. Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, Michelle.
Also with us is Richard Prince, who writes Journalism. It's an online publication about diversity in the media. He's here in our studios here. Richard, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thanks for having me.
So, Susan, you wrote, seems like, I would say it's a very tough piece. I don't know if you agree with my characterization. I think it's a very tough piece. And you said it's a piece that you did not want to write, but you felt you had to because of experiences that you have had and that you've noticed that other top women editors have had. Could you tell us a bit more about what conclusion you came to? Mm-hmm.
Well, I think my point was we don't need to litigate. We don't know what really happened inside, Jill Abramson's obviously dysfunctional relationship with her colleagues at the top of the New York Times. It's my view of that. It's sort of like a divorce or, every unhappy family is unhappy in its own way, and it's very hard for us to really know what happened there. But that if you pull back a bit, and you look at the extraordinary commonality of experience, bad experience, that many women have had at the rarefied air at the top of these news organizations. You know, let's be real. We've got a problem. There are basically no women now running any major news organizations with a small handful of exceptions. And how is that possible in 2014? My view, and this is based in part on my own experience, as the short-lived editor of national news at the Washington Post, is that there is a serious problem, that there is a gender bias that is really internalized inside of us that really strongly plays against women editors who are often judged, typecast for behavior that has been the ingredient of success for male editors.
You wrote in the piece, What I'm struck by is the depressing circularity of the whole conversation. You don't have to pronounce judgment on the merits of Abramson's tenure to be dismayed by the awful sameness of the charges that are hurled by those anonymous newsroom sources. The women are always labeled smart, but difficult, unapproachable, and intimidating. And you say it's not a question of their journalistic merits, but of their suitability, their personality. And so do you feel it's an issue where women journalists are not given the same opportunity to mess up in these jobs as men are, or to find their sea legs, as it were? What do you think?
Well, I think that's absolutely a part of it. Remember, we're talking about the very, very small handful who decide to stick with it as it is and who rise to the top of these organizations in the first place, which is basically, as you know all too well, it's so few, it's really shocking. If you told me that in college, that we'd be where we are today, with the small number of women in leadership positions to begin with in these organizations, I wouldn't have believed you. I would have been shocked. But having experienced it firsthand myself, I basically think every bit of experience that women have leads them to say, no way am I going to subject myself to that horrible treatment. And I'm really worried. I look around here in the Politico newsroom at all these wonderful, smart young women, and that's part of what drove me in the end to speak out, is a feeling that, this is really, something has got to change. I was in Paris the weekend before all this happened, very coincidentally, at a conference. My old friend, Nathalie Nougared, had become the editor-in-chief of Le Monde. She was also forced out of her job on the very same day, within hours of Jill Abramson. And again, that's part of what caused me to speak out. You could not find two women who have more different temperaments than Nathalie Nougared and Jill Abramson, both of whom I know and respect very much as journalists, and yet they were castigated and judged in the same terms. The news coverage about them used many of the exact same epithets, hurled by the same kind of anonymous newsroom sources who show up in stories like that. And again, I think that's what should cause people really to stop and think about this, and think about our assumptions about women, and how is it that two people and many others besides, could be labeled with such identical terms, who are such different people.
All right, Richard, let's hear about this and how it's being reported in your space, because, you know, under other circumstances, you have to believe that the rise of the first African-American executive editor for the New York Times would have been an enormous story, and it seems to have been subsumed under this other issue. You cover diversity both in the gender realm and also racial and ethnic and religious. So tell me how you respond to this story.
Well, I think that we're in grave danger here of universalizing one person's experience. And I've seen this sometimes with African Americans as well as women. Jill Abramson does not represent all women. I worked in the Gannett Company, for example, where Al Newhart was very strong on having women leaders because he saw what happened to his mother. And so I worked around many women editors. I've also had African-American editors. And some were good, some were not so good. We're talking about individuals here with their own personalities, their own quirks, their own people skills, their own management styles. And I think we're in danger here of, as I said, universalizing these experiences. It's not that you're a woman or an African-American. It's how you deal with those kinds of things. And some are better at it than others.
But I have to ask you, though, do you people have felt at times that, for example, you know, Barack Obama is not in the news business, obviously, but as a public figure, that he's been subjected to certain people imprinting certain things on him that they would not on a person of a different demographic.
That's true.
Okay. And so I just, you know, I just have to ask, is it your view that, do you think that this is becoming kind of a Barack versus Hillary kind of issue where it's like the rise of a person of color is somehow seen to reflect on white women in the business or something, like it's a zero sum situation, or how do you?
Well, that's true. I mean, it can be seen that way.
What are most of your correspondents and your telling you? I mean, you have had an interesting, a very lively discussion on your site about this.
Yes.
What are people saying to you?
Well, some people are talking about the issue of white women versus black men or black people in general. They're talking about the fact that when we talk about women in this situation, we're not really talking about black women. I don't know of any black women who've been promoted at the New York Times to any of these department heads positions under Jill Abramson's tenure, and that's being mentioned. I think that people are saying that they sort of resent Jill Abramson's case being made into an issue of pay for all women, when actually this is one case with one person's personality and one person's management style. And that's what I'm hearing.
Is that in part you think that they feel that this is overshadowing Dean Baquet's accomplishments, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner and previously led another major American newspaper, the Los Angeles Times?
That's true.
Is that part of it? Is it kind of, let's just be clear, is it racial defensiveness in part, you think, or a sense of hurt feelings on his behalf, do you think?
No, I don't think people are. Actually, people are not talking about Dean Baquet very much. They're talking about Jill, and they're talking about the New York Times, and how this whole issue has been hijacked.
Well, one person's hijacking is another person's hard
truth.
That's what they're saying.
Susan,
we only have about a minute left, so can I ask you tell me whatever you want to as a final thought. I'm interested in what reaction you're getting to the piece and whether you feel that any new conversations are being opened up about this.
Well, thank you so much. I've been amazed and overwhelmed by the overwhelmingly supportive reaction that's come from the piece, and I think it's because when we have a national conversation around this, it resonates with people. They connect with their own lives, their own experiences, and again, they don't know the specifics of what happened inside the New York Times, and that part of it is important but relevant, obviously, much more so to a small number of people who work inside the New York Times, and that was not the purpose of me writing this piece, except to say that I believe that we do have a crisis of women leadership in the country. And one thing...
I'm sorry, Susan, we're out of time. Apologies for that. And thank you so much for joining us. I apologize. Susan Glasser is editor of Politico magazine. She was with us from her offices in Virginia. Richard Prince writes the journalism's column on diversity in the media. He was with us in Washington, D.C. Thank you both. Switching gears now from print media to the web, we'd like to bring you up to date on two recent developments regarding the internet. First, Europe's highest court ruled that people can request that outdated and erroneous information about them be removed from the web. And here in the U.S., the FCC began debate over a new set of rules called net neutrality. Both developments have advocates and critics who both say that they're concerned that they could challenge the idea of an open and accessible internet. We wanted to try to understand these two important stories, so we've called Ray Junco. He's an associate professor at Purdue University and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University, and he visits with us from time to time to talk about technology. Welcome back, Ray. Thanks for joining us.
It's wonderful to be here, Michelle. Thank you.
So let's start with that FCC discussion. Late last week, the FCC voted to open a public debate for new rules that are said to guarantee an open internet. But other people are saying that these rules, if implemented, would actually mean that content providers would be able to pay to guarantee faster service for them, but then other people would get information more slowly. And I'm even confusing myself just trying to describe it. So can you help me here?
Yeah, I think it's really confusing, Michelle, because the direct statements coming from the FCC is that, you know, we don't want to use the fast lane language. But in effect, it is a fast lane because internet service providers like your Comcast can charge content providers, people like YouTube, Hulu, Amazon, and Netflix, to have their traffic prioritized and delivered to you faster. And so those who don't pay for those guaranteed fast lanes wouldn't have as much priority, so the data would get to you slower.
What problem are they trying to solve with these new rules?
I think the problem they're trying to solve is giving in to the cable lobby that wants to be able to charge more for these content providers that they feel are using more bandwidth and they feel they should charge them more.
Can I ask you to kind of handicap how you think this debate is going to go? Is it still kind of very much in the air, or does there seem to be kind of one direction or the other? Because on the one hand, it was reported last month that Tom Wheeler, chairman of the FCC, said, quote, "We will not allow some companies to force internet users into a slow lane so that others with special privileges can have superior service," end quote. He said that, but other people say, well, they don't believe that. What do you think?
Well, I agree with his statement. However, these proposed rules open it up for fast lanes. So in effect, it really would have the opposite effect of that statement. The plan is currently open for comment on the FCC's website. People can go to www.fcc.gov/comments and comment on it, or they can send an email to openinternet@fcc.gov with their comments.
Are there consumer groups that are paying attention to this, and have they coalesced around a particular point of view? Because you can see where, on the one hand, some people might say, well, what's wrong with paying more for faster service as long as everybody gets some service? Whereas you can see other people saying, you know, that's just not fair, since the airwaves are, you know, by definition a public good. You know, why should some people have favorite access to them versus others? You know what I mean? It seems like there's arguments on either side, right?
Sure. Well, the open internet has been a boon for minority voices to be heard, right? The fact that any blogger, reporter, or startup media outlet can have as loud of a voice as the more established, well-funded companies, that's the very foundation of democracy. You mentioned an interesting point there, because in this FCC statement, they say that they are willing to reconsider classifying internet providers as common carriers. Right now, they're classified as information service. Making them common carriers would put them on par with other industries that serve the public good, like transportation and communication. So they couldn't discriminate, and so they would have to treat all traffic equally. And I think some of the messages I've seen by groups like the ACLU are really supportive of classifying the internet service providers as common carriers, and I support that as well.
You were telling us that actually we pay more for inferior service here than other parts of the world. I'm not sure Americans know that. Tell us more about that.
That's right. In the U.S., we pay three times as much as in the U.K. and France, and five times more than in South Korea. We also have some of the slowest broadband globally. And the reason we pay so much and have such poor service is because we don't have a choice. Most markets are dominated by one company. For instance, I'm moving to a new community soon, and I was researching broadband service. There were two providers. I could either go with a service that would really struggle to stream online video or pay twice as much to get appropriate broadband. So guess what my option is? I paid double to get appropriate broadband. So in effect, it's a monopoly.
All right, well, let's get to one other topic very briefly. This is regarding Europe's highest court ruling. It requires search engines like Google to allow online users to be, quote, forgotten, unquote, after a period of time by removing links to web pages. And, you know, obviously the people who are advancing this say that they should have a right to, particularly when something is wrong or when it's outdated, or like say you shouldn't have to live with that information forever. But others are saying that this could undermine the essence of the internet, that it'll interfere with the free exchange of information. I think obviously this is a European court. Privacy rules are somewhat different than they are in the United States. But I'd like to get your take on this.
Gosh, Michelle, this is a mess. I'm a big supporter of the right to be forgotten, especially if we can implement something that's narrowly focused on minors, as has been done in the U.S. So, for instance, California passed a law that beginning January 2015, minors have the right to ask to remove any information they post online. The European court ruling, however, is completely different than this kind of legislation. It sets up this user-initiated takedown system that puts Google in the powerful position of being the arbiter of what's in the public's best interest to keep online versus the privacy interest of the individual who is making the request. That's a pretty powerful place for them to be in, and a bit scary.
Is there any immediate relevance for American consumers?
I'm not sure about that right now. I mean, it is a European decision. My understanding is that it cannot be appealed. So I think we're going to have to see how this plays out.
Ray Junco is an associate professor at Purdue University and a fellow at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. He was with us from member station WBAA, which is on the campus of Purdue University in West Lafayette, Indiana. Ray Junco, thanks so much for joining us once again.
Thanks so much, Michelle.
Coming up, the new show Fresh Off the Boat will be the first network sitcom with an Asian-American cast to make the air in decades. We'll ask columnist Jeff Yang, whose son happens to play the starring role, if the show measures up and if it could change the game for Asians on TV. That's ahead on Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Cancer Treatment Centers of America, combining conventional and integrative therapies to help maintain quality of life during treatment at cancercenter.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices, waltonk12.org. And from Inada, crafting shiatsu massage chairs for over 50 years and makers of the DreamWave Total Body Massage Chair at dreamwavechair.com. This is NPR.
This October, come aboard WILL's American History Train. We'll travel in private rail cars restored to their 1950s glory. Our private chef will serve delicious onboard meals as we travel to Boston, Washington, D.C., and Philadelphia for stops at historic sites, museums, and battlefields on this 10-day trip. For more information, call 217-333-7300 or visit will.illinois.edu/willtravel.
PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Yeah, I had an interview once, and the guy said, so what was it like taking the cameras to your village and the elders seeing these cameras for the first time? You know, these soul-capturing contraptions, you know, how did they feel about that? You know, we've had TV there for like 60 years.
I'm Marco Werman. Join us and hear The World.
Weekday afternoons at 3 on AM 580.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home, located at the corner of Elm and University in the historic Trevett Mansion, across from Westside Park in downtown Champaign. Owens Funeral Home, owned and operated by the Owens family since 1925, invites you to join them in supporting public radio.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. You may have to rethink your TV watching schedule now that most of the major networks have unveiled their new fall offerings, as well as which shows made the cut and which ones will fade to black. Later, we will hear from writer Jeff Yang. You've heard him here on both our Parenting and Barbershop roundtables. He's going to tell us about ABC's new show, Fresh Off the Boat, because his son is the star of the new sitcom. But first, we want to talk about some of the other new shows that feature diverse casts or people of color in leading roles. Here to tell us about that is Eric Deggans, NPR's TV critic. Welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get the bad news out of the way. Are there some standout shows that won't be making a return next season?
Critics seem to really like Trophy Wife, which was a show that was new on ABC that featured some people that folks really like from television, including alums from the West Wing and stuff like that. And it was about a guy who had a collection of ex-wives who were very quirky, but it just couldn't survive. And then critics also loved Community, this show on NBC that's always had a strong cult following, and they've always done really innovative stuff. They had an episode that was devoted to My Dinner with Andre, very ambitious movie. And they also had an episode this season that was a cartoon, that was like a G.I. Joe style cartoon. It was very, very inventive, but it just couldn't make the cut. It could not draw a big enough audience to stick for next season. And so it went out in a blaze of glory with a bunch of really good episodes this season.
But there are a number of shows with performers of color that have really taken off, and they're coming back, right?
Yeah, most definitely. We saw on Fox, for example, and we've talked about this before, they had several shows where people of color were co-leads. So they had a comedy called Brooklyn Nine-Nine with Andy Samberg and with Andre Brower as co-leads, and that was picked up pretty early. And then they also had a show called Sleepy Hollow, where they had a male-female lead, and the male was white and the female was African-American. That show was picked up for a second season really early in its run, and I think Fox is really bullish on it. There's a show called Resurrection on ABC that starred Omar Epps, and it's almost like a hidden success. That show has done pretty well on Sunday nights, and Sunday nights it has a lot of competition for viewers, and that's coming back next year. So I think ABC in particular looked at the success of shows like Modern Family and Scandal and Resurrection and said, you know what, we're going to double down on diversity with our new shows.
Tell us what's coming up and if you think there's kind of any through line there.
Number one, there's an uptick of shows that are created by people of color. So we have John Ridley, who's an NPR contributor, but also wrote the screenplay to 12 Years a Slave. You know, he got a show called American Crime on ABC. Shonda Rhimes is the best example of this, the creator of Grey's Anatomy and Scandal. She has a new show called How to Get Away with Murder, starring Viola Davis, who was nominated for an Oscar recently. And Shonda is going to have control of 3 hours of primetime television on the same night. I'm not sure any showrunner's ever done that, let alone a black female showrunner. And she's going to have two shows featuring black women, Scandal and this new one, How to Get Away with Murder. So not only are the characters diverse, but the people who are creating the shows and producing the shows and controlling the shows are diverse, and that's really important.
One more thought about Shonda Rhimes. You mentioned that she has become the most powerful woman showrunner in television. I just want to play a short clip from, what is it, How to Get Away with Murder? That's her latest offering, and here it is.
You don't want to be a sitting duck when the shooter gets here.
What?
My God, you have no idea what you just walked into.
Good morning. I don't know what terrible things you've done in your life up to this point, but clearly your comments are out of balance to get assigned to my class. I'm Professor Annalise Keating, and this is Criminal Law 100, or as I prefer to call it,
How to Get Away with Murder.
Well, that's that sounds kind of interesting.
She's a defense attorney who teaches a law class and uses it to sort of figure out young interns who can join her law firm. And so, it's Shonda Rhimes, so there's going to be sex and intrigue and politics and all that stuff. But it is very interesting and just wonderful to see a really diverse slate of characters, starting with the star all the way down.
There's one show that people seem to be already kind of buzzing about. It's called Black-ish, starring Anthony Anderson, Tracy Ellis Ross, and Lawrence Fishburne. And I do have a clip, and here it is.
Lately, I feel in order to make it, we've all dropped a little of our culture.
First up, Andy.
Sup?
Andy? That's not even close to Andre.
I think it says I'm edgy but approachable.
I think it says I hate my father and I play field hockey.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, my goodness. I know.
Well, tell me about this. I mean, what's happening here?
Well, this show, what's interesting about this show, okay, it's a show about a wealthy African-American man played by Anthony Anderson. You've seen him on Law & Order and other shows. He is worried that his kids are not as connected to black culture as they should be. And so, you know, the show is all about him trying to get them connected to their roots and then eventually kind of understanding that they just live in a different kind of multicultural world than he did when he was being raised. But what's interesting to me about this show is that this is a concept that several entertainers of color have talked about and have pitched as series. John Leguizamo had a similar idea for a series, I think, that was advanced in the last pilot season for this current TV season that we were on now, and ABC didn't buy the show. And Chris Rock has told comedy routines about this, about, you know, how do you deal with the fact that you're wealthy and your kids of color have a very different experience as wealthy black kids than you had growing up when you didn't have much, and you feel like they don't have the same kind of values that you do. So Lawrence Fishburne, for example, is an executive producer on this show as well as a co-star. So these are people who know media, they know black culture, they know television, and hopefully they'll be able to take this idea, which seems like it might be a little touchy, seems like it might offend some people, and really do something cool with it.
Some of the shows that have been successful in recent years, like Shonda Rhimes' Vehicles, race is part of it, but not central to it. Right. But it's different now with these, with a show like Black-ish, ethnicity is central to it. And I'm just interested in how you feel that's going to work.
Well, you know, as you know, I mean, as people of color, we often talk about race, but race is never the sole definer of who we are. Right. So even though the shows may be focused a little bit more on ideas of race, I'm hopeful that the characters won't all be about that. I don't think the subject matter is as important as the characters. If you feel like you're watching people deal with a racial issue, that's great. If you feel like you're watching a collection of stereotypes deal with a racial issue, you know, that's like an after-school special or something.
It's interesting that over the years, Eric, the fact is we've talked from year to year, where some years there are virtually no people of color in any significant roles on the new offerings. And then all of a sudden there's this kind of that many flowers bloom happening.
Right. Right.
What's the critical piece? Is it a critical player like Shonda Rhimes in a position as a showrunner, or is it the census, or what do you think is the critical piece here?
One of the critical pieces is that shows that have had diverse casting are being successful. When people see that they can have Shonda Rhimes create a show with Viola Davis, or Lee Daniels, who directed The Butler, has a show on Fox called Empire that's starring Terrence Howard as the guy who leads a family-run hip-hop music empire. ABC also has a show called Cristela that's based on a Latino family. And they also have a show called Fresh Off the Boat, you mentioned, featuring an Asian-American family. That's the first time we've had a sitcom with an Asian-American family in something like 15 or 20 years. So I always say imitation is the sincerest form of television. So, you know, if a couple of the shows really take off, people will rush to imitate them the same way they rush to imitate the Cosby Show. And conversely, if a lot of these shows don't handle race well, it may be harder to get the networks to opt in like this, you know, the next season. So it's important that they handle these themes well and that these shows are successful in their own terms to encourage the industry to keep doing what they've already started.
Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. We reached him at his home office in St. Petersburg, Florida. Eric, thank you.
Always fun to be here.
Now we want to talk more about one of the shows that Eric just mentioned earlier a few minutes ago. It's a sitcom recently announced by ABC. It will be the first network family sitcom in two decades to feature an Asian American cast. It's called Fresh Off the Boat.
Me? My American dream was to fit in.
Why do all your shirts have black men on them?
It's Notorious B.I.G.
You're in a B.I.G.?
Yeah, man.
Come sit with us.
Oh, what is this?
It's Chinese food. Oh,
get it out of here. Ying Ming's eating worms.
I need white people lunch.
That young voice you hear repping Biggie is Eddie. That lead role is played by 10-year-old Hudson Yang. He happens to be the son of one of our regular contributors, Jeff Yang, who writes about media for The Wall Street Journal. And Jeff is with us now. Welcome back. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I know,
it's,
right?
It's just so hearing the trailer the looking makes you glass.
Laugh, right?
Yeah.
So the show is based off the memoir of celebrity chef Eddie Wong, who's it's also called Fresh Off the Boat. So tell us, for people who haven't read the memoir, which is also hilarious, what's the show about?
So the show is about, it's basically a childhood memoir for Eddie himself. I mean, he looks back at being raised by immigrant parents in a very non-immigrant setting, shall we say. His family moves from urban Washington, D.C., Chinatown in Washington, D.C., down to suburban Orlando. And it's really, as much as anything else, about what it's like to be surrounded by a world you did not create. So it's a bit of a fish-out-of-water thing. But I think what's really fascinating about it is the degree to which the tropes that this show has feel so decidedly different from other sitcom comedies, family sitcoms that are out there right now.
Well, you were saying, you said in your piece, and you've said to us that even if your son were not the lead, you would still think this was a game changer. And tell me why you think that.
You know, I am radically unobjective about this show, as you might guess.
Full disclosure, we got you. But the fact is, this is you watch all of these things. I mean, you are a critic, a writer. Mm-hmm. You know,
so what I think is really fundamentally different about this show in particular is this is, in a lot of ways, the first Asian American sitcom, and maybe certainly the first Asian American family sitcom. There have only been two, really. That is unapologetic about its status as an Asian American show, as a show that deals with and confronts a lot of the issues around, you know, kind of being other in the context of the United States. And even the title, which obviously has been controversial in some circles, and is one that speaks to this almost, you know, embrace of a refusal to just thoroughly assimilate.
Well, you know, the other thing you compared it to the 90s sitcom All American Girl, which also featured an Asian American cast. That was the first, and to this point, until now, the only. The lead was comedian Margaret Cho, and I just want to play a short clip to jog people's memories.
So. I have a date with Kyle.
Kyle? You're not still seeing him. Oh, I don't like him.
You don't have to like him. He's dating me.
He's wrong for you.
I'm not going to get into this, Mom.
Oh, good for you, Margaret. For once, we can have a nice family meal without you and your mother.
Okay, why is he wrong for me? And I hope you've got something better than he's not Korean.
I do. He's American.
Oh, well, I've got news for you, Mom.
Well, you know, you panned the show when it came out, not the only person to do so. What was wrong with it? I mean, what is it that you feel that they got so wrong that you hope this show gets right?
So this is kind of my karma on some level. 20 years ago, I was the television critic for The Village Voice. And I did, in fact, pan this show almost reluctantly on some level. There was a lot of hope, a lot of expectation around this first opportunity for Asian Americans to be represented in this most American, most mass, if you will, of television categories. And it was so – I mean, it's called All American Girl, right? And it was so – almost defensively kind of reiterating these tropes around how Asians are different and exotic and kind of strange. And it took Margaret Cho's humor, which takes those things and tends to subvert them and kind of play them out at the edges and turn them into, as you can hear, a laugh track, multi-camera, you know, very, if you will, white family sitcom kind of template. And it just ran – it sounded wrong. It ran wrong. It felt very much like the butt of the jokes was the family itself.
It felt like you said in your piece, you said the humor was actually – it seemed that people were laughing at them, not
right.
with them. And it also seemed that Margaret had just been – gosh, what word did you use? Tranquilized or something like that? I mean, I think she's made no secret of her unhappiness at that experience. I think she said it's one of the worst experiences of her life.
It sent her on this crazy downward spiral. And I mean – you know, it was not only obviously a terrible, terrible thing for her, but in a broader sense, it sent us wandering the wilderness for about 20 years when it comes to this particular kind of comedy. Well, there's not been anything since, right?
Well, people of Asian heritage have had some strong roles in other vehicles, but they didn't feature. They were, you know, they've been featured players like, for example, Sandra Oh in Grey's Anatomy and in Lost, and people have had sort of meaty roles in diverse cast, but this is the first time that this family is going to be front and center, and their experiences will be front and center. So, what do you think that they get right that will make people want to watch, and not just people who really resonate with that particular experience, but the broad audience that you really need to be successful?
Well, it is a universal story, as they say, because it's about a family, and it's about a family kind of growing together as they face the sort of challenges of the world around them. But I think what's actually really exceptional about this, and you can even tell, again, the name of Margaret's show was All American Girl. This one is called Fresh Off the Boat. That Fresh Off the Boat is something the family itself embraces kind of unapologetically. And Eddie Huang, who has used Fresh Off the Boat kind of as his brand for the past decade or so, everything he does is called Fresh Off the Boat. He says it's about this love of where he comes from, this decision that he can be American, but he doesn't want to just be American. There's something deeper, and he's not afraid of essentially calling out where his roots come from, where his identity is. That's new for Asian Americans. I mean, that's something I think we don't see a lot of.
Well, let me ask you about one other element that you heard in the trailer that his mom is asking him, that his TV mom is asking him, how come all his shirts have black people on them? Is that piece that not just the trifecta, not just the Asian white dynamic, but the Asian black white dynamic part of the show too? And is it going to be the kind of thing that's going to make me cringe?
I hope not. But there definitely is. There's definitely a sense in which for Eddie, as with a lot of kids growing up in the 90s, hip-hop ended up being kind of a lifeline. I mean, here he was. He had immigrant parents whom he loved but who didn't understand him fully. And he's surrounded by, certainly in Orlando, kids who didn't get him for being Asian. Hip-hop, it's really fascinating. There's a scene actually in the lunchroom of their school in which basically these white kids and Eddie bond over their mutual love of hip-hop, where this African-American kid says, what is going on here? That was a real thing, right?
It was a real thing. Well, we'll see. We'll see. Well, good luck. Congratulations.
Thank you. Hopefully
it all goes up from here and not down. And good luck to your son, and tell him congratulations from us. We'll be watching.
Thank you, Michelle.
That was Jeff Yang, columnist for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Jeff.
Take care.
And that's our program for today. You're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.